I'm Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check. Reality Check is produced by National Review and is one of more than a dozen podcasts offered on the National Review online website. If you'd like a free subscription to the podcast so you never miss a program, please sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Arizona is one of the best states in the country when it comes to empowering parents with the choices they need to get the best education for their children. Our guest this week on Reality Check gets at least a bit of the credit for that and much, much more. John Schilling is the president and CEO of the American Federation for Children, where he's a strong and effective advocate for revolutionizing our antiquated K-12 system and moving into the 21st century. Along the way, John served for 4 years as the Associate State Superintendent and Chief of Policy at the Arizona Department of Education. He was also Chief of Staff for the Education Leaders Council here in Washington, D.C., has worked for 3 members of Congress and 2 state governments. But most importantly today, and for today's purposes, John is not only a good friend, but he has helped lead the fight and the charge for educational freedom for kids all across the country. John, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So before we really jump into a lot of the substance, I would just love for our listeners to hear a little bit about you. I mean, you and I have known each other for probably almost 20 years, it's been, since we were both involved in some of the early fights for educational change. How did you decide this was your path?
How did I decide this was my path? So my first part of my career was involved with largely with politics. And I remember having a conversation with an early mentor of mine who was Pete Wilson's chief of staff, former senator of California, former governor. And he said, John, you are a universalist. You are good at a lot of things, but you are an expert at nothing. So I took that advice to heart. And as luck would have it, my family and I moved out to Arizona in 1997. And I had lined up one job with Congressman J.D. Hayworth, which was great. It was part government, part political. But I was interviewing for a job with the governor of Arizona, Jane Hull, and with this woman we know called Lisa Keegan. And it became abundantly clear to me which job I should take. And I went to work for Lisa, and that was how my education reform career started 20 years ago.
That's fantastic. So I love to engage the audience a little bit in the historical context of what's going on in our nation when it comes to education, which is much more than education. It's really public policy, because oftentimes many of us have not had the luxury you and I have had to be around these people. So talk a little bit about those early days when you were with Lisa Graham Keegan and why that had an impact on what we're doing today.
So it had a big impact on what we're doing today, because one of the great things about working with Lisa, as you know, is that she has one gear, and it's forward. And she was elected statewide, so she was not beholden to the governor.
Hang on. She was elected as state superintendent,
right? She was elected as state superintendent in November 1994. So I joined her partway through her first term. And at the time, what they were going through in Arizona is a big school finance crisis, because you had all of these districts in Arizona in wealthier parts of the state that were able to build really great schools. And you had all these schools in South Phoenix whose roofs were crumbling, because they didn't have the bonding capacity and their voters would not support that. So Lisa took on her own party, and went to bat for this, and it became a real cause. And what we learned then is when it comes to education reform, when it comes to fighting to change this very antiquated system, you got to fight. And one of the things that I realized very quickly, thinking naively that I was going into the policy arena and therefore I was leaving politics, was that education is about the most political thing you can do, mm-hmm. particularly when you get to the state and local level. So it taught me a lot of early lessons. But the most important thing was you need to have an ambitious agenda and you need to pursue it vigorously.
And most people think about educational choice and some of the work in that environment as just about one issue, but it's not. It's about what you're just saying, too. It's about all the issues. I mean, when you're talking about choice and different tools and levers to provide parents power to make choices about their kids' education, requires you to know something about standards and the condition of education, requires you to know something about school funding. So in that way, kind of being a universalist, the original criticism, right, by Governor Wilson's chief of staff is right, but it's a good one. So why do most people think that we're so limited in our scope?
That's an excellent question. So for as long as I've been involved in this movement, when I talk to people who don't know much about what we do, they continue to say, well, you choice people, you just believe that choice is the silver bullet. And I always respond to them, that's not what we believe. What we believe is that we are one very important part of the piece, part of the puzzle. You've got to have choice as part of all of these other things that you were doing if we're going to change the system and improve outcomes for all kids. You have to do it all.
And so full circle back to the state of Arizona. So Arizona was one of the pioneers in the education reform movement. Thanks to then Superintendent Lisa Graham Keegan, yourself working with her, people in legislature. You even had now Senator, U.S. Senator Jeff Flake heading the Goldwater Institute, helping write some of that legislation. And then, you know, something interesting happened. They passed a great charter school law. Today they have a number of educational choice programs. And everyone called them the Wild West and said they were crazy. But then things got better with kids. So how can you have the Wild West and then things get better?
Choice works. And when you put parents in the driver's seat, what you find is you're going to give a lot of kids that don't have options. You're going to give a lot of parents the power to really find the best educational environment for their child. And what people find is that that works.
Right. And so the data suggests that students in traditional public schools improved by as much as 8 to 10 percentage points, particularly poor and minority kids, on state tests.
Yeah, fabulous. You mean, you give people choice, and suddenly you got all parts of the stool that are improving.
So let's take that national. Does that mean that great data, that everybody is just rushing to your door at the American Federation of Children, not the American Federation of Teachers, by the way, which we'll talk about, the American Federation of Children saying, hey, we want what you're packaging and selling? Like, is it easy to get people to do this?
I wish it were. I wish it were that simple. I remember a few years ago, I was interviewing a young woman to be part of our development team and explaining to her what we do. And she got done with our conversation. I don't know why everybody would not want to contribute to this. Well, it's a little bit harder than that. You referenced the union. The union cares a lot more about defeating school choice than they do about defeating merit pay. But for whatever reason, this is the number one target, and it makes things very challenging in a lot of states around the country because you are going up against some deep-pocketed folks who really work very hard at defeating this stuff.
And so you guys started a PAC a few years ago, right, to try to help address the political challenges.
Yeah, so back in 2009, we joined forces with an organization that was the political arm of the school choice movement. And we brought everything under one roof so that we do educational and promotional work, we do lobbying and advocacy work, and we do state political work all in one organization. And that proved to be very beneficial, particularly as we went into the 2010 elections when the landscape around the country began to change. And so there are large intersections with this work. You can't just do educational and promotional work and expect to be successful. You can't do lobbying work alone and expect to be successful, or even the political work. You have to do all three types of this work because you need the politicians that are going to get elected, who are going to fight for this stuff. You need them to advance these high-quality pieces of legislation, and then you got to go out and promote and educate. You got to do all three of these things, and it was a really good formula.
You know, it's really interesting you say that, John, because I know, I don't know about your experience, but mine has often been, and many of the people we talk to on this show, and again, for those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to Reality Check, and I'm talking to my good friend John Schilling, who's president and COO of the American Federation for Children in Washington, D.C., a lot of the work that goes into policy advocacy and politics, just the basics that sometimes legislators are missing is information. the number of people that I meet on a daily basis, it's like someone once used this analogy with me, that it's like a passing parade. Just when you think everyone's seen the elephants, there's a whole nother group of people who are like, oh my gosh, there's elephants in the parade. Monkeys, it could be the Irish dancers I saw at the St. Patrick's Day parade, whatever. But the reality is there are people who go, oh, I didn't know that you could actually improve kids' performance by giving parents a choice. I didn't realize that parents knew how to make choices. I didn't realize that school choice programs get roughly half sometimes, if not 70% max for per pupil funding. The number of, I didn't know, give me more information, even among hostile people. So how much does that education piece play a role, just informing folks? Because a lot of people listening out there probably think it's really kind of simple, but it's not.
It's super important. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do is we try to go to a lot of different meetings and forums and events, oftentimes where we are surrounded by people who, shall we say, are anti-private school choice. But then when you sit down, you actually begin the conversation and you actually start talking about exactly what we do, who benefits, and what these programs, how these programs are really structured, you begin to see a little bit of a change. It's like sort of the seas parting a little bit. But you got to keep working on these folks. This is not sort of a one and done thing. You have to just keep going and repeating the same stuff and getting the information out there in order to get more folks on board.
Well, and one of the things you guys have shown also, that it's kind of a misnomer. This is not about just people who believe in free market or conservative principles, right? I mean, we've got how many states now of school choice? And
so we have 26 states plus D.C. with 52 publicly funded private choice programs. Almost a half a million kids this year.
So that's extraordinary. And that didn't happen because all of those states and communities were run by conservatives.
No, it didn't. And, you know, and Florida is probably the best example of this, where over the last, 15 years, we've built some pretty strong bipartisan support. And sadly, one of the ways that you have to ultimately get bipartisan support is when you ultimately get kids into the program, and then these families go and visit, for the most part, their Democratic legislators, and they say to them, this program is working for my kids. And that's ultimately how you begin moving them. Because absent the kids being in the program and absent being able to demonstrate to these policymakers that your constituents are benefiting, sometimes it's difficult to get them around the corner.
Yeah, I remember talking to an African-American Democratic state legislator in a state who wasn't sure about how he was going to vote on a school choice program, and then he told me his granddaughter was in a charter school in the city that we were in. And I was like, oh, well, I guess you want to preserve that, don't you? It really helps when you not only can see it, but then you have experience in it. You've got that great poster in your conference room at the American Federation of Children with literally thousands of people marching on Tallahassee, mm-hmm. with one of your board members, mm-hmm. John Kirtley, and a whole bunch of black pastors and mm-hmm. leaders of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
So it happened because over the course of time, our folks in Florida, led by John Kirtley, really made a concerted effort to get African American pastors involved in this movement. As more and more children began joining the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program, the Step Up for Students organization did a very good job of cultivating relationships with the families and ultimately turning these folks into advocates. And it got to the point in 2014 when Governor Scott was running for re-election. He was running against Charlie Crist, who I know you remember, mm-hmm. Former Republican governor who became a Democrat in order to run for governor again. He had been a longtime supporter of the Tax Credit Scholarship Program while he was governor. When he became the Democratic nominee, that support went away, and he opposed the program. Governor Scott was a huge, full-throated supporter of the program. And in 2014, when Governor Scott was running for re-election, he went from 6% of the black vote to 13% of the black vote.
Oh, my gosh.
He won by 66,000 votes. Single-issue African-American voters were probably the difference.
A lot of governors or people running for governor, we've tried to express that to over the years, and some of them just don't buy it. Yeah. I remember, and I have no problem saying this on online, so to speak, Governor Bob Ehrlich was running for the second time as Maryland governor. And I said, you know, Governor, I think that going into Baltimore with me and going across the state and talking to folks who these programs really impact, they're part of our bread and butter, and they're part of our team. In fact, they're partners. We've learned so much from them nationally. He said, no, they'll never support a Republican. And frankly, they don't care, right? Mm-hmm. People, you know, this is something Howard Fuller often talks about. Howard was actually my first ever guest on the Reality Check podcast. Mm-hmm. And politics doesn't matter when it comes to your kids. He and others often remind us. When mm-hmm. it comes to this issue and where your child is sitting, if you have a better idea, people, no matter who they are, what they look like, shape, size, color, whatever, don't have that problem kind of jumping over what might be a traditional line mm-hmm. of demarcation for them politically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen that in lots of different states. Any other interesting states where you've seen strange bedfellows come together and support great options for kids?
So we've had some success in Louisiana. We've had some success in North Carolina. And look, I mean, this is an issue where you will often get liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans to come together. There was a survey done last year, and they were looking at all of the issues that the president was supporting. And the one issue in which there was the most bipartisan support was school choice. Like you, we spend a lot of time trying to educate Republican policymakers that if they want to build a bridge to non-traditional constituencies, the people who typically do not support them, there is no better issue to do this on than school choice. And it's a tough slog to get them to buy into this, despite what you can show them with the polling, despite what you can show them with what has taken place in some states around the country. They need to be continued. We need to continue to push them on this, because this is an issue that's going to broaden the tent of the party.
And it's not only going to broaden the tent of the party, it's going to make everyone's communities better, right?
That's right.
So let's talk about those folks on Capitol Hill, a few miles from where we're sitting right now as we speak. So we've talked about history. We've talked about some of the record, 26 states with private school choice programs, 44 plus the District of Columbia with charter school laws. All of them, by the way, are great, but they could be so much better. Not all of them are great. Most of them are good. Some of them are great. All of them could be better.
On both private choice and charter.
And charters,
absolutely.
Right? More expansive. And sometimes on Capitol Hill, you would think that none of this stuff was happening. But the good news is there's been some rays of hope that there could be some federal programs that help enable more opportunities for kids to have the choices that really best fit their needs. What's the current state of play with potential federally focused programs?
So there are a lot of very good ideas out there for federal action, that would complement what states are already doing. There's a proposal out there to do choice for children in military families. AFC is very supportive of this. There's a proposal out there to do education savings account for children who are in Bureau of Indian Education schools, some of the worst schools in America. This would be a great thing for the feds to do. The proposal that we are most excited about is a proposal to do a K-12 federal tax credit, which we believe would have the broadest impact across the country, where you could have corporations and individuals who would contribute to scholarship granting organizations who would then hand out scholarships to eligible children. This would have a tremendous effect in two ways. Number one, you could extend this option to states that do not currently have this option, which would be fantastic. music. The second way it would be tremendously helpful is it would augment scholarship amounts in states with existing programs, which we believe would dramatically accelerate the number of children who are participating in these programs because they would now have a much more robust scholarship amount. And of course, that's particularly helpful for low-income families because the scholarship amounts are often very low, particularly in tax credit scholarship states. Mm-hmm. If you have another revenue stream on top of that, you're going to make that a much more robust scholarship, and you get a lot more kids participating in these programs.
So what would it take to get this thing enacted? And is it standalone? Is there a bill yet? What do we need to know?
So the dynamics in Congress being what they are, it is not possible to move a standalone school choice bill through the United States Congress because it would never get 60 votes in the Senate. Because the Democrats would filibuster it. So the only way that you can get any of this stuff done is by attaching it to a larger product. There was an effort last year to try to attach the federal tax credit to the tax reform bill, mm-hmm. Which was done as part of budget reconciliation, only requiring 51 votes in the Senate. Because it took so long to get to tax reform, when we got to the very end, the votes were kind of nip and tuck, mm-hmm. And I think there was a reluctance to add something that would be deemed controversial to that. But that's got to be the path in 2018. We've got to find a moving piece of legislation. Ideally, we find something that could be done as part of budget reconciliation, mm-hmm. But failing that, it's going to have to be part of some larger product.
And there's some suggestion that that there's a lot of interest in creating workforce and apprenticeship tax credits.
Absolutely.
That having it part of that package to show the difference, you know, because there is this connectivity between making schools better work better for kids and making economies work better for grown-ups who also need skills retraining. And some of them need even to finish high school.
Absolutely. This was something that the president talked about during the campaign. Other presidential candidates talked about this during the campaign. Not every child is going to be going off to college. But if we can figure out a way to have some sort of workforce credit where they can get the kind of training that they need, that may be just the thing to get the business community excited about this. Mm-hmm. And I think getting the business community excited about this and perhaps pairing this with K-12, could be a very exciting way to go.
And talk to me about the role of the president in this and the education secretary. The secretary has experienced no dearth of criticism. She was the lightning rod and an example, I think, for her opponents about, or made an example of by opponents. You work with Betsy DeVos when she was chairman of American Federation for Children. And I know there's a Chinese wall because she can't be involved with her former organization anymore, so there's not tons of contact there. But what can the education secretary do to help support this effort? What can the president of the United States, let's say he actually turned on National Review's reality check tomorrow as opposed to Fox News, President Trump, what should he be doing and his people?
Go big, go bold, Mr. President. I think we are fortunate that we have a president, a vice president, and a secretary of education who are all full-throated supporters of all options for kids. If anything is going to get done on this front, they are going to have to push and lead. That's the only way something's going to get done. And, you know, what the secretary could do is more of what she's been doing, which is to go out and use that bully pulpit, explain to people that this is really important, that we do have an antiquated system. I sat and listened and worked with her for many, many years. And when she goes out and she talks about rethinking schools, mm-hmm. and there's all these news articles that say, oh, well, she's just trying to bury school choice because it's not. That's not at all what she's trying to do. These are things that she's been talking about for 10 years. It is part and parcel of the same thing. It is taking this antiquated 19th century system, moving into the 21st century with innovation and choice as the engines. That's what she is for. And I think she's got to use that bully pulpit to go out and do it. I have to believe that she is talking a lot with the president and the vice president about how important this is to the future of education in this country. And I'm sure she may be making the case to them. We have plenty of choice in higher ed. The one place we don't seem to have any choice is in K-12. So why is that? Why is it? Why not Pell Grants for kids, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's very supportive of Pell Grants at higher ed. Why not Pell Grants for K-12? So I think there's a, you know, there's a lot that they can do to get out there and really elevate this issue. And I think they have to do more of that. And I think that they're going to have to push Congress to do it. I'm hopeful they will.
You know, it's interesting. There really is a double standard. I would go to Secretary of Education Arne Duncan during the Obama administration, and some of his staff, who, by the way, were always very open and welcoming. They made it very clear they didn't agree, whether it was on, you know, D.C. scholarships or different ways they might work with charters, although they were modestly supportive. They're always open and very clear about talking to people on all sides and use the bully pulpit in some ways very wisely for their particular issues. And yet, when Education Secretary Betsy DeVos does that, she's considered out of touch, right? Questioning what's happening. And I think, you know, in the Arne Duncan / Obama administration education department, they recognized the Department of Education was no place for policymaking. They had a little bit of a heavy hand, but they even knew that they could spur local action with that Race to the Top program. Mm-hmm. Agree with it or not, they were taking their case to the states and communities to demonstrate that if you held a carrot out and people chased it, you might make change. Mm-hmm. And I think a similar effort now would be considered out of touch. And you know, you and I have both been in the Federal Department of Education. It's like the walls are really thick. Like, there's not a lot that you can, like, hear outside. And so you have to get out. And you have to hear other people. And that isn't where policy is made, even if it's where rules are made that sometimes impede good decisions.
Yeah.
So if you were education secretary, what would you do more of, differently, additionally, or not?
Well, Just to go back to Arne Duncan for a moment. So keep in mind, you know, the teachers union actually called for Arne Duncan to resign.
Right, right.
So just to give you a sense of, where they are
right.
on all of this stuff. But look, one of the reasons I think that she has become, secretary has become such a target of criticism is, a lot of folks are learning for the first time what those of us in the school choice movement have known all along. The union really hates this stuff, right? They really do.
Mm-hmm.
And they really will go to the wall by any means necessary to defeat this stuff. So in order to move our agenda along, I think what we have to do is, look to what we've done in the states. We go and we make the case. We build coalitions. We educate people. We have good, aggressive lobbyists that are going to go and get this stuff passed. If I were secretary, I think what I would be doing is going out and making my case out of Washington mm-hmm. in a lot of places, to go and highlight the schools that are taking advantage. The schools in states that have a lot of choice, both charter schools, private choice, go out and highlight these schools. She's been doing a lot of this. I think she needs to do more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she needs to direct her team at the department to go and make the case to members of Congress. Look, these are the things that we ought to try to do. And this is not about federal, quote, programs.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about the feds taking over K-12 education. What this is the feds facilitating action that is going to complement what is already going on in the states to make it better, to create greater opportunity
right.
for kids. That's what this is about. And that's, I think, the direction they need to go.
And I think that's a great, great response, John, and great advice. I also, the model should be Bill Bennett circa 1983 to 87 when he went around and said, and that's not good, and Chicago's the worst public school system in the country. Look what's happening in D.C. It made remarkable progress, and a couple of cheaters are putting a black mark on the progress mm-hmm. that charters, choice, performance accountability made. And so to have the education secretary commenting on that would be amazing, frankly, for all of us to know about that, because systems are broken. Our kids were not designed to be educated by systems. They were designed to be, our kids need to be educated by people. And frankly, today they can learn a lot from folks outside the schools because we're in a day and age of technology where, as a good friend of mine says, knowledge is no longer a commodity. You can access it anywhere. It's how someone helps you and what you have access to and your experiences that can help you most achieve in life. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, as I know many people listening do, that choice is the bedrock of that. It's one tool in the toolbox, but it's a fundamental one. Right. And without it, how do we make change?
That's right.
Any other last thoughts for our listeners about what we're doing and what we can do to be better and more responsive?
Well, I think that the most important thing all of us can do as advocates is put our foot on the gas. We need to get out there. We need to go and make the case, and we need to force change. When there's a landscape like this in Washington, D.C., you really do need to go big and go bold. You need to push. I think there are a lot of states that are doing that. I always worry about what I like to say is creeping timidity in the states. I think we need to keep our foot on the gas until we reach a point where every child has access to a great education and where we are improving outcomes for all kids across the board.
That's fantastic. John Schilling, thank you for joining me, President and COO of the American Federation of Children. This has been Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. Reality Check is a twice-monthly podcast produced by National Review and posted at nationalreview.com in association with CER, the Center for Education Reform. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free to make sure you don't miss any future programs. You can also subscribe at all these really cool technological places that they have now, like iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And you can also find much more information about education, the workforce, and compelling issues surrounding our country and our kids and learners at all levels at the Center for Education Reform website, edreform.com. Come visit us. I'm Jeannie Allen.